morning. We welcome you to our third day of oral argument in March, and want to welcome Loyal Middle School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a program that has won national awards. It's a program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to attend an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they're given materials that the oral argument that the students will hear. They may engage in activities relating to the judicial system. They come, hear an oral argument, and at lunchtime, after the second oral argument, they will meet with a justice who has been assigned for the day to meet with students and anyone else who wishes to attend this session. The discussion at the session is about the procedures the court uses to accept review of a case, to hear the case, and to issue its opinions. The discussion is not about the substantive issues of any of the cases that we are hearing. Does anyone in the courtroom need a summary of this case? Right? If you need one, raise your hand. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Zeigler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice assigned to meet with you at lunchtime. My immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. Having introduced you and having introduced the court, I am now going to call our first case, 2013 AP 557 CR, State versus Charsky. Arguing on behalf of the state is Marguerite Moeller, Assistant Attorney General. She will argue, if she wishes, for 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. And arguing on behalf of the defendant, Corey Charsky, will be Matthew S. Penix. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. This matter is here on the state's petition to review a court of appeals decision reversing a judgment convicting Corey Kucharski of two counts of first-degree intentional homicide in the shooting deaths of his parents and remanding the matter to the trial court for a new trial on the question of Kucharski's sanity or mental responsibility. The appellate court's reversal was not based on any error it perceived in the sanity phase of Kucharski's trial, nor was it based on a determination that trial counsel were ineffective. Nor did the Court of Appeals discern any type of unfairness that infected the sanity phase of that trial. Instead, the Court of Appeals exercised its discretionary power of reversal under the miscarriage of justice prong of Section 752.35 because it found a substantial probability that a new trial would produce a different result. There are two issues before this court. First, did the Court of Appeals erroneously exercise its discretion when it granted a new trial on sanity under the miscarriage of justice prong? And secondly, regardless of whether the court believes the Court of Appeals properly exercised discretion, should this court tighten the standards for granting a new trial under the miscarriage of justice prong to require not only that the appellate court be able to declare that there is a substantial probability of a different result on retrial, but that that finding must also be coupled with a finding that there has been some type of error, whether it is reversible error or not, some type of misfeasance of trial counsel, whether or not that misfeasance rises to
counsel,
the level...
Even under a discretionary review, how does the Court of Appeals have the power to make a factual finding?
I don't think that they... Generally speaking, the Court of Appeals does not have that power. The Court of Appeals did not sit there and listen to Dr. Roski testify. And I think, as my opponent basically admits in his brief, this was a matter of the Court of Appeals substituting its judgment for that of the trial court. And here we have the trial court, Judge D'Amato, sitting as the finder of fact on the question of sanity. Basically, the court went through all of the evidence, and by that I mean primarily the reports that the two doctors, Roski and Dr. Pankevich, submitted, and found that the evidence really weighed on the side of Kucharski's insanity defense, and therefore gave him a new trial on that basis. And admittedly, there is language in some reported cases, including Murdoch from the Court of Appeals, which indicate that all the Court of Appeals has to do is find a substantial probability of a different result. And the state does not believe that that should be a sufficient finding in and of itself. Yes, it should be a prerequisite, because why go back and have a retrial if there isn't
a
substantial?
My question maybe wasn't very well phrased. The determination of whether someone is not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect is a factual finding,
correct?
It's made at the circuit court. Here, it appears from your discussion that, and your opening remarks specifically said, the Court of Appeals made a finding, okay, that the result would have been different. Having sat on the Court of Appeals for 7 years before I came here, it was always my belief then, and it continues to be my belief, that that court does not have the institutional ability to make findings of fact. The only way they could come out differently is if all of the facts could give only one result, and then you interpret the facts not to make a factual finding, but you say as a matter of law, you could only come out with one result. Correct?
I understand better now what you're saying.
Yeah,
what
and
you're
that's
saying.
What was bothering me about
and,
this. Okay.
And I don't think this was a case where the Court of Appeals went ahead and actually said, we're going to declare that Mr. Kucharski did satisfy, end of story, we're going to enter a verdict of NGI. They didn't do that. But in granting the defendant a retrial on the issue of sanity, what the court didn't do was to identify in any way why this case is an exceptional one. And this court and the Court of Appeals...
I'm going to interrupt you, too. I agree that the Court of Appeals should not be making factual findings. But as a matter of law, not a factual finding, but as a matter of law, an appellate court can determine that the circuit court's conclusion, finding of fact, determination, whatever you want to call it, is such that one of the parties, whether it be the state or the defendant, did not meet the burden of proof.
Correct.
That's a question of law.
Correct. Right. You can find that something either satisfies a particular burden,
right,
as in the sufficiency of the evidence
right
challenge.
Right. Exactly.
That's correct.
or a clearly erroneous challenge, if you prefer to put it
that
way.
You're referring to a factual finding, correct? Right. The appellate court can say this finding was clearly erroneous.
Clearly erroneous, or that it showed the party who had the burden of proof did not meet the burden of proof, right?
Correct.
So we agree on that, and we agree that if that was what the Court of Appeals said, then it would fit under the, 751.35, right? 752, thank you.
Well, if they found that it was clearly erroneous, then I think that would be, you wouldn't even have to get to necessarily the interest of justice.
But,
and I think,
you know, that it helps.
It helps, right. But right. That dovetails into...
Or if the Court of Appeals would find that the party has not met its burden of proof, that would satisfy your standard. If I understand what you're arguing for the state, it is that the court should clearly state, this is on page 33 of your brief, the court should clearly state that the Court of Appeals has to identify some error or some unfairness that therefore renders it exceptional and justifies discretionary reversal, namely substantial probability that the result will be different. It's a two-part test, right?
Correct. That you do have to find, right, as prior cases establish, the substantial probability of a different result. But the state is saying there has to be more than this.
Right.
We're not saying it has to necessarily be error. It can come from a variety of sources. And I think this case actually, if you look at the facts here, and I didn't even, I guess, realize this until I reread the entire transcript of the sanity phase, there was a pretty substantial argument here. I'm not saying it would be definitive, but a pretty substantial argument on ineffective assistance of counsel, which was raised at the Court of Appeals level, but the Court of Appeals didn't even acknowledge that that argument had been raised. And the state believes that in order for a case to be exceptional, and this court has said that most recently in Avery, that the Court of Appeals has a responsibility to analyze why a particular case is exceptional. If you can reverse a conviction or if you can overturn a finding of sanity on a basis that is well established, and ineffective assistance of counsel is certainly well established. There are very definite rules for determining deficient performance and prejudice. Then you shouldn't automatically jump to looking at whether reversal in the interest of justice is possible, because a case is not exceptional if there is regular error.
Counsel, yeah. By saying that, you are reading out of the statute book 752.35, because I hear you saying, maybe I'm not hearing you right, that you got to find some excuse that fits. So you have to apply all the standards of ineffective assistance of counsel, right? If you do that, you don't need 752.35. Now, you said that twice in response to my questions. So if you have to have something that fits into another niche, into another box, you don't need 752.35.
That's right, you don't. But what the state is saying is that you should first analyze that. But even if you don't, let's say this case doesn't satisfy ineffective assistance because under Strickland you have to show prejudice. And if you look at the ineffective assistance claim that was raised in the Court of Appeals, it was that why didn't these attorneys call all three doctors? Why didn't they introduce exhibits? And to be honest with you, when I went back and reread it, the ineffective assistance claim that was raised there could have been a lot stronger, because what happened here was that the defense attorneys thought they had a slam dunk on the question of sanity. So when they got before Judge D'Amato, first of all, I found it shocking that one of the two attorneys didn't even know what the burden of proof was. There was a discussion on whether the burden was a simple preponderance or whether it was clear and convincing. There was no opening statement. Decision was made to call only one live witness. And then when the prosecutor vigorously cross-examined that one live witness, there was no redirect whatsoever. Closing argument, the public defender gave like a two-paragraph summation which only mentioned one of the two prongs of the test for insanity, even though all three of the doctors agreed on the other prong. She didn't even mention it. And then the prosecutor got up, and he argued at length that Kucharski had not met his burden, not to show that he had a mental disease. Everybody agreed that Corey Kucharski is a schizophrenic. The disagreement between the public defenders and the prosecutor was on whether that schizophrenia caused him to lack substantial capacity to either appreciate wrongfulness of his conduct or to conform his conduct. So after the prosecutor gets up and argues, no, he didn't meet it, the public defenders didn't even give a rebuttal.
Counsel, so, is the Court of Appeals wrong in paragraph 37 when it states that the expert testimony was uncontroverted, that both Dr. Roski and Pankowitz opined that Kucharski lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions and or to conform his behavior to the requirements of law? Is that wrong?
It's uncontroverted by any other expert. It was not uncontroverted by the prosecutor. And I think that's...
And what testimony did the prosecutor put on with regard to whether or not Kucharski lacked substantial capacity?
The prosecutor did not present any evidence. Instead, he relied on a very vigorous cross-examination where he got Dr. Roski to admit that there were some red flags in this case. For example, the conclusion of Dr. Roski was that Kucharski could not appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct because of these command voices that were telling him to kill his parents and to kill himself. And
did both of the doctors test, or was there, does the record substantiate that both doctors' testimony was to the requisite standard?
Well, there was only one doctor,
but
and I think I believe that their reports were to the requisite degree, the two major reports.
That's why I asked the record as opposed to the testimony. So
right.
Both, in that regard, both expert testimony was uncontroverted to the requisite standard. Paragraph 38 of the Court of Appeals opinion indicates the error of the circuit court. And that the error of the circuit court, if it was error, but at least that's what they determine, is that that the circuit court seemed to indicate that the requisite standard had to be for certainty. And, of course, there's always that anomaly in the language of the requisite standard. A reasonable problem, you know. If you have an opinion to reasonable probability, then it inserts the word certainty. But, of course, it never met real certainty. And that's what the Court of Appeals takes the circuit court to task for with regard to paragraph 38, perhaps 39 also, I guess. So isn't that the error that they're finding, that the circuit court held the doctors to a standard that isn't the requisite standard?
I believe that, taken out of context, the Judge D'Amato's comments were that even though she valued the opinions of the experts, she agreed that Kucharski was schizophrenic, so she didn't disregard them altogether. She thought it was speculative for them to say that when he killed his parents, he was acting under the influence of the command voice. And when she used the word speculative, she was actually referring to Dr. Roski's own testimony, where he said, "We are required to speculate somewhat in this case because, unlike a lot of other cases where an insanity defense is raised, here you had, unfortunately, no treatment records of mental health history for Kucharski, and you had no eyewitnesses or any other lay witnesses called at all, which differentiates the case from a lot of other cases where you did have occurrence witnesses or you did have records that predated the commission of the crime." And this kind of goes back to my original point on why the Court of Appeals, in our opinion, erroneously exercised its discretion, because this Court in Sierinski and Pouts has said that a fact finder, whether the fact finder be, as it was here, the trial court, or it could be a jury, as in some other published decisions, has the right to reject the opinion.
I have a question for you. It goes back to my original, where we agreed that if there wasn't sufficient evidence to support the burden of proof, that's error, right?
Right.
Error of law, right? Okay. And once you get an error of law, then you can use discretion. I mean, that's the state's position, right?
Right. You had an error of law, and that's not, in our opinion, what the court found.
Well, I looked at the amicus brief, and on page 6 of the amicus brief, they argue that, and Justice Bradley referred you to several paragraphs in the Court of Appeals. I'm going to refer you to different paragraphs. I'm going to refer you to paragraph 35 and paragraph 44. And the argument is that these paragraphs show that the Court of Appeals essentially found or determined that Kaczarski had not met his burden of proof, and that the circuit court's determination that Kaczarski had not met his burden of proof was erroneous. So in 35, it says in the second sentence, the evidence showing that Kaczarski lacked substantial capacity either to appreciate the wrongfulness or conform his conduct, as we will discuss more fully before, very strong and certainly comprised the greater weight of credible evidence, citing to 971.15.3. And then at paragraph 44, the Court of Appeals said, considering the evidence as a whole, we conclude it predominates quite heavily on the side of the defendant. Defendant had the burden of proof?
Yes, the defendant had the burden of
proof. And what was the standard of the burden?
It was supposed to be a preponderance of the evidence.
So they looked at all the evidence as a whole, and we conclude the evidence predominates quite heavily on the side of the defendant on the issue of his mental responsibility. So why can't you read all that as saying that the evidence here was such that the defendant did meet his burden of proof, and the circuit court erroneously held as a matter of law that it didn't? If you put it in that posture, it fits the state's argument, the state's requirements.
I believe the Court of Appeals could have said, we find this clearly erroneous, and then explained why it was clearly erroneous. But I don't think that these paragraphs rise to the level of clearly erroneous. They represent the Court of Appeals' disagreement with the Circuit Court's determination that Kaczarski did not meet his burden of proof. They're saying, we think he did meet his burden of proof because the evidence was very strong. The evidence being very strong, number one, doesn't necessarily rise to the level of making Judge D'Amato's factual finding clearly erroneous. Now, if the Court of Appeals had done this and said it was clearly erroneous, to be quite honest with you, I doubt that the state would have filed a petition for review. But because of the process that's used here, that you go ahead and find that there should be a new trial in the interest of justice under miscarriage of justice, and I think just the terminology, miscarriage of justice, has the connotation that there was something unfair or wrong in a case.
So what are the magic words that should have been used here? Clearly erroneous?
I think that was a possibility, or ineffective assistance of counsel, or
right.
a lot of different ways they could have gotten to the same.
And if you said any of those, you never have to get to mistrial. You never have to get to discretion.
If you can justifiably say that, correct,
yeah.
That you wouldn't have to reach the whole question of should we exercise our formidable power of discretionary reversal. Why is this case an exceptional one? And I don't think the Court of Appeals complied with what this court said it should be doing in Avery. It did not identify that, and part of the problem is that it jumped immediately to finding a miscarriage of justice without any analysis of the other contentions, the other arguments that Kucharski had raised. And
I'm going to interrupt you one more time because the yellow light is on. What is the standard for, what is our standard in reviewing? It's my understanding that the standard that we use is, did the Court of Appeals abuse its discretion? Right?
That's correct. Your standard is erroneous exercise of discretion.
And so we look to see if there's a factual error in the Court of Appeals or an error of law. Right?
Correct.
In essence, or that there's no rational basis for its decision making, right?
Correct.
And ordinarily, when we look at a circuit court, which is the more usual case, right, for non-exercising discretion properly, we also sort of can fill in the holes, can't we?
Sorry, fill in the holes?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the court can say, hey, they didn't say it, but it's obviously clear from what they said or didn't say, and the looking at the record, that that's what the trial court was arguing or was agreeing
correct.
To
do. This court definitely can say, well, maybe you didn't use the magic words,
right.
but can still perceive.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to clarify that we are reviewing the discretionary decision of the Court of Appeals under the usual rules of reviewing discretionary decisions.
That is correct. And the state recognizes that because that is a pretty daunting standard, that we have a tough road to hoe in convincing the court that by basically substituting its judgment for that of the fact finder on this issue, that this was an erroneous exercise of discretion because Judge D'Amato explained why she was rejecting the conclusion that Kucharski did not, or why she was finding he did not satisfy his burden.
Here, the Court of Appeals also explained it. So we are reviewing, and sometimes the standard is, you know, could a reasonable court come to that conclusion under a discretionary or deferential standard of review. Here we're reviewing their exercise of discretion, right?
That's correct.
Court of Appeals.
When we do that, don't we have to look at what the trial court did because that's what they evaluated as they exercised their discretion?
Yes.
What I wanted to get to is this. The idea that you suggested that there was a arguable, and I think you even put it a little higher than that, ineffective assistance of counsel claim in the Court of Appeals, but that the Court of Appeals didn't grab onto that. Instead, they went just with the discretionary reversal under 752.35. If you prevail, if the Court of Appeals erroneously exercised its discretion with regard to discretionary reversal under 752.35, should this case be remanded for them to address the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was never raised?
Most definitely. There's not just ineffective assistance, but there was a claim raised by Kucharski that the trial court had used the wrong standard, and I think there was a third claim. And the Court of Appeals didn't address any of those, so that if this court agrees that granting a new trial in the interest of justice was an erroneous exercise of discretion, by all means, it should be remanded to District 1 for them to decide the remaining issues.
Could you remind me what the consequences would be if the defendant were found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect?
He would be committed with the possibility of reexamination, and to be honest with you, I don't remember what the statutes say anymore about how frequently he would be entitled to a reexamination to see if he no longer was dangerous.
Yeah.
So potentially he could be committed for life.
Okay, but potentially he could be committed for less than life.
Definitely true, especially since in this case, Kucharski was not getting any kind of medical treatment for his schizophrenia at the time of the murders. Now he is. So, and I don't know what his current mental status is.
So part of the issue facing the circuit court was in the face of two brutal homicides, which were conceded, and a defendant who was claiming he was not guilty by mental disease or defect, but had never had any treatment for his mental condition, who there was some alcohol involved the day of the incident, and had prior methamphetamines that may have contributed to his mental condition. The burden on the defendant was to show that he lacked the capacity to understand the difference between right and wrong, or whatever the statute says here, conform his conduct to the requirements of law.
Right. Either one. He could either have demonstrated that he could not conform his conduct, or that he did not appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Arguing on behalf of the defendant is Matthew S. Pinnix. Mr. Pinnix.
Counsel, the podium goes up, and you're tall enough that you probably should do that. It'll help us hear you better.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice. May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Attorney Mueller, I am Matthew Pinnix, and I speak on behalf of Mr. Kucharski. With me at counsel table is Michael Sukup, who is another lawyer in my office. I am here today to argue for the broad discretionary authority that this Court and the Court of Appeals have enjoyed for a long time. This Court has had the power to reverse as an independent exercise of its discretion if it identifies that justice has, for any reason, miscarried for over 100 years. The Court of Appeals has enjoyed that same power since its inception. I am here today to argue against this Court constraining its power and constraining the power of the Court of Appeals to do justice to the parties when either court identifies as an act of its independent discretion that justice has for any reason miscarried. For those are the words in the statute by which the legislature gave this court and the Court of Appeals the authority to reverse under an act of independent discretion. If a review of the record demonstrates to the court that justice has, for any reason, miscarried, it can reverse.
Do you understand the state's argument to also include 751.06, which is our statute, that is the giving, addressing the Supreme Court's discretionary reversal in the interest of justice? Do you understand their argument to ask us to also be curtailing our authority, or just the authority of the Court of Appeals vis-a-vis their discretionary reversal statute of 752.35?
Thank you, Justice Bradley. I can read the state's argument in no other way, given this court's prior interpretations of 751.06, which is the statute granting it the discretionary authority to reverse, and 752.35, which is the statute granting the Court of Appeals that power. This Court has been very clear that the powers under both are coterminous. The language in the statutes is identical. The Court of Appeals was given the very same power by the very same language that this Court enjoys. And while the state does not come out in its brief and say it, Your Honor, the state's brief can be read in no other way, unless, of course, it is this Court's prerogative to, by this case, determine that 751.06 and 752.35 are not coterminous and must be interpreted differently.
No one reviews us for arbitrary or abuse of discretion or erroneous exercise of discretion, unless it becomes a federal case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's the difference between the two, isn't it?
Yes, this court reviews the Court of Appeals for the erroneous exercise of its discretion. Anytime that the Court of Appeals exercises its discretion, its independent discretion. And the review is for erroneous exercise of discretion is well known to this court. It requires an analysis of whether the court considered the appropriate facts, applied the relevant law, and reached a conclusion that a reasonable jurist could reach. The Court of Appeals did that in this case.
Where?
The Court of Appeals reviewed the record, and it determined that the facts that were in evidence were such that Mr. Kucharski could prove beyond a preponderance of the evidence a conclusion that is a matter of law, that Mr. Kucharski has satisfied his burden. And because of that, there's a substantial probability of a different result should the case return for a retrial.
If the Court of Appeals decides Kucharski met his burden, then it is also deciding that the trial court erred by saying Kucharski didn't meet his burden.
Your Honor, I want to parse this finely.
Okay.
And I think it's quite important to parse it finely. One of the other issues that was raised in the Court of Appeals by Mr. Kucharski was whether there was clear error in the finding of the trial court with regard to Mr. Kucharski's mental responsibility. That issue was not addressed by the Court of Appeals. It instead reversed as a matter of its discretion. Mr. Kucharski specifically asked the Court of Appeals to determine, under the standard associated with clear error review, to determine whether or not the trial court's findings were clear error. What the Court of Appeals did in this case was not to say that the findings of the trial court were wrong, but rather to say that there is a substantial probability of a new result given the evidence in the record. Now, I understand that those are quite similar, and I can see where there could be some confusion trying to parse them finely. But again, what this court is doing in this case is reviewing the discretionary determination of the Court of Appeals when it decided that there is a substantial probability of a different result, and because of that, justice miscarried. That is the miscarriage of justice that the Court of Appeals identifies as the any reason within 752.35. The miscarriage of justice is the fact that an individual received an outcome in a trial that cannot be supported by the evidence. That's the fundamental unfairness. The state wants to say that there's no unfairness here. To me, that's the fundamental unfairness. As Justice Rogenczyk pointed out, appellate courts don't like to get involved in the nitty-gritty of factual findings and, in fact, aren't imbued with the power to get involved in the nitty-gritty findings of fact. That's not what the Court of Appeals did here. Instead, it reviewed the record as a matter of law and determined that as the record exists, there's a substantial probability of a different result. There's no dispute. There are no factual disputes in this case. As Justice Bradley pointed out during the state's argument, all of the experts in this case agree. All of the experts in this case agree that Mr. Kucharski was both mentally ill and unable to conform his conduct to law, or alternatively, to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct. Let me briefly point...
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a minute, if I might. I want to look at this from the point of view of what Judge D'Amato found. And you tell me where her findings shouldn't be appreciated and weighed by the Court of Appeals. Now, I marked some of the things here that I found looking at the record. The trial court found that Kucharski did not meet his burden to prove that he lacked the capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. The trial court found that Kucharski did appear to understand that his actions were illegal. The trial court found that he did not act on the voice's orders to kill himself or engage in a shootout with the police. Thus, she found he had the ability to ignore the voice's commands. The trial court found that Kucharski had mentioned that his actions would result in him rotting in jail. The trial court found that Dr. Rosky and Dr. Pankowitz were speculating when they indicated that he could not meet the, or that he could meet the test in regard to the capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. Aren't those important findings by the circuit court? How can the Court of Appeals just ignore that and say, too bad, so sad, we're going to reverse?
Let me first, if I may, address, Your Honor, the fact that the trial court did not make the conclusion that Mr. Kucharski could not conform his conduct to the requirements of law. That is a, if we want to talk about, if the state is going to ask us to find additional error that may constitute a basis for reversal in addition to a substantial probability, let me point to that one. During the trial, it's the decision hearing that is record number 53. It occurred on 9/27/2010. When the court gave its decision, the court said that Mr. Kucharski cannot prove to me that he cannot appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct. When then pressed by Mr. Kucharski's counsel to make another determination, which he is required to do, which is to determine whether or not he can conform his conduct to the requirements of law, the circuit court said, I don't have to do that.
Well, isn't it not an and connection, but an or connection?
Your Honor, if he can prove either one, he can succeed under his burden. So in order for the court to have found against Mr. Kucharski, she had to have determined that he can't prove either. She determined that he could not prove one and made no finding on the other. That's an error. And that would sustain even under the state's test, would sustain the reversal by the Court of Appeals. We want to talk additionally about attorney misfeasance. Let me first say I don't know what that means, and I don't think the state's test is sufficiently formulated to identify what that means. And indeed, I think that's a reason for it not to be accepted. But I, too, agree with Ms. Mueller that there are things within the record that would suggest misfeasance. I'm interpreting to be something less than deficiency under the ineffectiveness standard. And let me point out what that is. Mr. Kucharski tried to withdraw his plea after Gene D'Amato determined that he was not entitled to be held not mentally responsible. During that plea withdrawal hearing, his counsel testified. Counsel testified that they told Mr. Kucharski to plead not guilty and go to the NGI stage because it was a slam dunk victory. They told him, one of his attorneys used the word lawless. It would be lawless for Judge D'Amato to reach a conclusion other than that you are not responsible. One of his attorneys guaranteed Mr. Kucharski that he would be found not responsible. If we're going to talk about something that is misfeasance, that's misfeasance. Those are the things that can be identified in this record as it exists to satisfy even the state's test, which we are arguing should not be adopted because, again, I believe it's poorly formulated. It's not clear enough to allow litigants and judges alike to understand how to apply it. It would constitute a constraint on this court's power and the Court of Appeals' power that there has been no call from either court for a need to be done. Not the Court of Appeals has not asked this court to evaluate it. This court has never said it has trouble applying its discretionary reversal standard. It's inconsistent with this court's prior cases. We have Kemp, which even the state says has to be determined to have been wrongly decided if you're going to reverse in favor of Mr. Kucharski. we have, and pointing to the exceptional nature of this case, first let me say that under the relevant standard, the question becomes not is this case exceptional, but rather did the Court of Appeals erroneously exercise its discretion in determining that it was exceptional? But with regard to its exceptional nature, in the amicus brief, they point out that there have been four cases in the last 41 years in which reversal has occurred in mental responsibility cases for a miscarriage of justice.
In fact, just in the Court of Appeals, I read the brief and it said appellate courts, and I'm never sure if they were including us.
I would have to assume it includes both, because okay. They reference Kemp, which is one of this court's cases. But if I could just point out some statistics. On average, over the past 15 years, the Court of Appeals alone has handled 2,000 cases. If you extrapolate that back over 41 years, that's 82,000 cases.
They're not all NGI cases.
That's right, Your Honor.
So, you know, I think that's a small number.
That's right, Your Honor. They are.
First NGI case I've heard here since I've been here, and it's 11 years.
Which I think, Your Honor, goes even further to the point of the exceptional nature of this case.
I would like you to look at what kind of a test actually is applied when the Court of Appeals decides that it is likely that there will be a different result, or probable there will be a different result with a new trial. Do they do an assessment as we would do on a sufficiency of the evidence assessment, or what is it that they're doing for that test?
Your Honor, I believe the review is of the record, so that means it can incorporate only the evidence that has been entered into the record. Maybe the court file and the transcript is the entirety. If the supplementation to the record is done, it would incorporate that. And then the review would be to look at the information, the evidence presented, and to determine based on the evidence presented whether there is a substantial probability. We're not talking about a reasonable probability. We're not talking about a probability. We're talking about a substantial probability, which means...
Sounds like sufficiency of the evidence to me. Is that right or wrong? I mean, if you look at that, is that what they're doing? Are they weighing the evidence to see whether it was insufficient to support the determination of the circuit court?
Well, I can only point out that some of the cases before have suggested that it's not a sufficiency test because in our brief we indicate to the court that there are cases in which they have not determined the evidence sufficient. Excuse me, they have determined the evidence to be sufficient, and yet nonetheless reversed in the interest of justice.
Okay, so it's not sufficiency of the evidence.
It's not, and nor do we think it is a review for whether there should have been a directed verdict given. The test under sufficiency of the evidence requires deference to the court that is being reviewed, as we point out in the brief. Insofar as when one is asking whether the evidence is sufficient, one takes every reasonable inference in favor of the verdict. There is no such similar limitation to an application of the test for discretionary reversal.
Counsel, I've been looking at trial court's decision, which is oral, and I've been looking at the red brief, that's the state's brief, which has the transcript. And at page 134 and 135, it says what you said it said, namely, the defense counsel said to the trial court, you have held that you cannot appreciate the wrongfulness of the conduct. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's in 134. And then defense counsel says, my understanding is that the court has to find whether he could conform his conduct. Right? It's an either or.
Yes.
But if you're going to hold against him, you have to find that he didn't do either one of them.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
And the trial court judge says it is an either or under the statute. I can't explain it any better than I have. So the trial court here never explained whether he could conform his conduct, right?
Yes, and I would...
There's further discussion here. and there's discussion that the defense counsel bring in another brief on the issue.
Well, they don't brief that, Your Honor.
I understand that. Okay. That's my question to you.
No, they didn't.
And then there's some discussion about it, but then they're going to go ahead and sentence anyway.
Yes.
It's never briefed.
Yes.
So why, maybe you do argue this, why isn't it a matter of law that the trial court erred here because it did not make a required determination?
Your Honor,
that he was able to conform his conduct.
I believe it is error, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
I believe it is error.
As a matter of law.
Yes. And that is the error that I am pointing to that would sustain it. But let me just note.
Let me interrupt for a minute and follow up with something. On the conform the conduct, my understanding is that the trial court noted that Kucharski apparently acted on the voice's orders to kill his parents, but he did not act on the voice's orders to kill himself or engage in a shootout with the police. Thus, he had the ability to ignore the voice's commands. Doesn't that go directly to the idea of conforming his conduct? Maybe she didn't say directly in regard to conforming the conduct. But that particular finding, it seems to me, says the same thing. Now, tell me how I am wrong.
In answer to Your Honor's question, if I could just complete the portion of the transcript that the Chief Justice was asking me about at the Petitioner's Appendix, page 135. Mr. Kucharski's counsel then said, well, I thought it was and conform his behavior to the requirements of the law. Judge D'Amato says it's not. So Judge D'Amato made no finding with regard to whether he could conform his conduct to the requirements of law.
Well, that certainly sounds like a finding to me.
Where is that?
She said it's on page 135, and it's an either or under the statute. I don't know. Well, I can't explain it any better than I have.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, I think she recognized she had two standards, and she thought that she met them both by what she said. And if you go back to page 131 of the petitioner's brief, actually 130 of the transcript coming out of the petitioner's appendix, she goes through from there all the way through the next page talking about exactly the findings that fit. I think she said she's done the best job she can explaining it. I don't think she misunderstood what the standard was at all.
Your Honor, I guess the only thing that I could say in response is I don't think that's not my interpretation, and I don't find it consistent with the request from counsel to ask. I thought it was to conform his behavior and to conform his behavior to the requirements of law, and for the judge to then say it's not. I find that
not what she says. Page 135. He says, Your Honor, my understanding that the court has to find whether or not he could have appreciated the wrongfulness of his actions and also that he could conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. Judge D'Amato, it's an either or under the statute. And I can't explain it any better than I have.
Right, Your Honor. And then if you then subsequently, this may just be a point on which you and I are never going to see eye to eye, but if you read the next four lines of the transcript, there's additional clarification requested from trial counsel saying, well, I thought it was and conform his behavior to the requirements of the law, which I read as suggesting, well, court, if you're going to say he doesn't succeed, you have to make a decision under both. And Judge D'Amato says, it's not. That's how I read this.
Well, what he says to her is, she says it's an either or. His statement is then, well, I thought it was and. Okay, so the conjunction is not or, it's and. Conform his behavior to the requirements of the law. And Judge D'Amato says, it's not. And she's correct. The statute is, as you've represented to us, an or. He can prevail on either of the prongs.
All that the court needed to have said is, but counsel, I've already concluded that he can't meet either standard.
She did say it was an either or before, and then he tells her, no, the conjunction is and she says to him, it's not. It's not an and.
Yeah, I don't mean to be disrespectful. I just think you and I are never going to see eye to eye on this.
You've got a different job than I do. You do it well.
Yeah, I read it a little bit differently.
Yep, that's okay. So with regard to conforming his conduct to law, sounds to me that's not a finding of fact. That's a conclusion of law. That's the legal standard. But I may be wrong. How do you see it?
Well, it's my understanding that there have been cases in which the court have indicated that the determination of whether the defendant is mentally responsible is the finding of fact.
Is a finding what?
A fact.
And so conforming his conduct, his ability to conform his conduct to law is a finding of fact. You're saying that's what the precedent is.
That's how I have seen these courts' cases, the language I've seen them use.
Can you help me out with this? The Court of Appeals did not find that the trial court erred, right?
Okay, I guess, Justice Ziegler, this is where I would very much have a different opinion than the state.
Okay.
The state wants to say that a determination that reversal is required under the interest of justice does not constitute error. From my position, if the legislature...
That determination in and of itself means there must have been...
constitutes error.
Okay, but I'm being a little pickier than that, I guess. Often we get these cases kind of coupled together with newly discovered evidence or something else that was an error that was argued. And then the fallback argument is, and, you know, if you find that wasn't error, then in the interest of justice, we're asking for a reversal. Do you see what I'm saying?
May I answer with more than a yes?
Sure.
I do see what you're saying, Your Honor, I do, but what I would say as an appellant litigant, that when I include requests for reversal in the interest of justice, I am requesting it as an alternate basis of relief.
Okay.
I'm not saying, you know, it's like, I think to read a request for relief under several issues as, and then interest of justice as a backup, would be as though saying if I raised ineffective assistance and I raised the Fourth Amendment, that I'm saying, well, the Fourth Amendment is just give me a bone here. I don't see it that way.
All right. Fair enough. That's fair. Often, though, I mean, you have to agree. Often there's sort of an argument on a specific kind of evidence or a specific kind of error that happened that a defendant's asking for relief based upon, right?
Yes. And
my question is broader than this, so I don't want to just sit here and, you know, have a discussion on this issue. I'm asking you where in the Court of Appeals opinion did it demonstrate the exceptional nature of this case such that no specific error has to be outlined, and where did the Court of Appeals demonstrate that it wasn't just substituting its judgment for that of the trial court? Give me the, because of this, it's such an exceptional case that these two criteria are met and reversal is required in the interest of justice. You see what I'm saying? It'd be easier for you if the Court of Appeals said the trial court erred in this regard, and because of all those errors together, the interests of justice require reversal. You would agree, right? You don't want the standard to be, gee, you know, I just want to insert my judgment for that of the trial court or that of the jury. I mean, maybe you would, but that's not the law, right?
Well, I certainly think that the legislature thought it was when the legislature told this court and the Court of Appeals that if you, for any reason, believe justice has miscarried, and let's be fair, substantial probability doesn't occur in that statute. The language of the statute, the controlling language of the statute, is whether justice has, for any reason, miscarried. If the court determines...
If this were a jury trial and we took it on bypass and we were taking a look at it, What deference, if any, would we give to the jury's determination?
Right. In the cases that we've cited, I think it's Hentz and Palladino and others, in which they've granted reversal on the miscarriage of justice prong, those were jury trial cases. And the same review was conducted. The same review. Does, to me, this statute seems like the legislature's grant of authority to these courts to do justice to the parties when perhaps these courts cannot find a sufficient legal basis on which to otherwise do justice.
I know your light's on, and I want to be fair to you, and I want to give you the chance to really answer my question.
Okay.
I'm asking you to point to the spots where they show that it's not just a substitution of their judgment for the trial courts.
Sure. The Court of Appeals, and where it begins the analysis section of its opinion, which I'm having trouble getting to, at paragraph 31 through the remainder, that's at Petitioner's Appendix 113 through the remainder of the opinion, goes into extrinsic detail of an explanation of how this case is exceptional, pointing out that this is a case in which there's no dispute between the experts, pointing out how this is a case in which how no one disputes that indeed the defendant is in fact mentally ill, points out that this case is substantially similar to Kemp, and then identifies distinguishing features from Kemp, but yet weighs those in Kucharski's favor. Kemp is another reversal in the miscarriage of justice prong in a mental responsibility case, and the Court of Appeals takes the specific time to point out how this case is similar to Kemp, and how that indicates its exceptional nature. Those facts, the agreement of all of the doctors, there's no dispute here. There's no credibility concerns that we see in some of the other cases that where miscarriage of justice reversal has not been extended. Everyone is on the same page. Everyone is on the same page but Judge Jean D'Amato. Everybody is on the
Judge
same page.
Judge Brennan, really, you know. In all
depending on how you look at it, Judge Brennan says that Jean D'Amato got it right. So insofar as that, sure.
Well, she goes further than that. I think she says that really the Court of Appeals is just inserting its own, substituting its judgment for that of the trial court.
But, Your Honor, that's what an appellate court does. To be fair, an appellate court is imbued with the power to review the findings and conclusions of the lower court, and then to make determinations on the standards of law that are set for it, and thereby determine whether there has been an error that necessitates reversal. And as we point out in our brief, the power of the reversal in the interest of justice is such that it does allow, by very virtue of the test that it requires, it does allow a reviewing court to substitute its judgment, because there could be no other way for reversal under the miscarriage of justice for a substantial probability, unless a reviewing court were to look at the determinations of the lower court or the jury, as you've pointed out, and say, on the record, the information in the record demonstrates to us that justice has miscarried because there is a substantial probability of a different result. To make that conclusion, a substantial probability, the appellate court has to have the power to review the evidence in the record and make a conclusion as a matter of law as to whether the party. And let me just point out briefly.
Except we don't get to do that, right? We're the only ones who don't get that kind of leeway.
You would, Your Honor, have that leeway were this case before the court in a request asking this court to reverse by exercise of its independent discretion under 750-106. And, in fact, I've seen cases in this court where a defendant has asked, hey, court, if you're not going to give me relief under the reasons I've alleged below, please give me relief under 750-106. Now, I just want to – my red light is on, if I may just finish this answer.
Do it quickly, please. Thank you.
The state's rule wouldn't apply only in NGI cases. It would apply to civil cases. The state has asked – use language to say NGI, but if this court constrains its power under NGI, the door is open to constraining the power in all their cases. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Moeller.
I'd like to answer several questions that arose during the course of my opponent's argument. First, I believe Justice Bradley asked, does the state's argument apply equally to this court's power of discretionary reversal under 750-106? And the answer is yes. But I do have to add the caveat that, as this court has recognized in State versus Henley, this court also has an inherent power of discretionary reversal, And in Henley, the question was left open as to whether or not the Court of Appeals also enjoys such an inherent power. That question was brief but not decided in the Henley case. Second of all, did Judge D'Amato apply the wrong standard when she looked at the second half of the test for insanity? That was one of the arguments raised in the Court of Appeals but not pursued in this court as an alternative basis to affirm the Court of Appeals. And I think the answer to that is clearly no. If you look at the Court of Appeals brief the state filed, at pages 4 to 5, I quoted from 53-7, transcript number 53, page 7, where Judge D'Amato specifically addressed both prongs. First, she said, I'm finding him legally responsible because I'm not persuaded beyond a level scale. I can't. It's not tipping even slightly that he lacked substantial capacity to conform his conduct to the law. So that's one half of the test. Then a few paragraphs later, same page, she said, what the speculation is whether in killing his parents he could not appreciate. He lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct. I'm not convinced that he did. So in reality, Judge D'Amato knew that there were two prongs, and she found out that Kucharski did not satisfy either one of them.
Counsel, you are asking us, I think, to curtail our powers, to read into the statute, if they're the same, ours in 751, the Court of Appeals in 752. Given that that power in this context has only been exercised, according to the amicus brief, four times in 41 years, doesn't appear to me that it's been exercised willy-nilly. Why would we, why in the world would we write in language to curtail our authority or power into the statute?
Because I think even though we're talking about only four cases that deal with miscarriage of justice reversals for sanity, that the language in the cases would also apply to any kind of reversal based on a miscarriage of justice on the guilt phase of a trial.
Okay, and I mean, would it also apply more broadly to actions advanced by your opposing counsel? I mean, I just, it's an anathema to me that to embrace without some hesitation an argument that we should write into the legislative mandate, that is the legislature's statute, language that requires additional considerations to be made which result in us limiting our authority. So I again say, why in the world would we do that?
This court has already, by virtue of interpreting the language in 752.35 and 751.06, has already written in language. The statutes say nothing about a requirement that the appellate court has to find why a case is exceptional, has to analyze that. I don't think the statute talks about a substantial probability of a different result on retrial. So those glosses, interpretation, have developed over the years. And I think what's also worth noting is that when you look at some of these, what I would call almost ancient cases like Hintz, Palladino, those cases arose at a time when there was only a Supreme Court and there were fewer avenues to reverse a trial court than are now available to the appellate courts of this state. You didn't have claims of ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland as an avenue for reversal. You didn't find cases that reversed on that basis. And that also brings me to another question that came up that I think my opponent, I disagree with the answer he gave. The question was, when you decide whether there's a substantial probability of a different result on retrial, are you limited to looking at the record? My red light is on, but if I could just...
Please respond.
Are you limited to looking at the record below? And I don't think the answer is yes. I think the answer is no, and the case cited in our brief, Pate versus State, is a sterling example of that, where there was evidence that the defendant had that would have exculpated him in an armed robbery was never presented because he was afraid if he presented the evidence and basically fingered who the real armed robber was, it would endanger the lives of his five children. The Supreme Court found that it didn't satisfy newly discovered evidence because he couldn't show he wasn't aware of it. But yet, this was incredibly unfair to have him stand convicted of a crime for which he was sentenced to 20 years because he had this very honorable motive in telling his attorney, don't put on that evidence. So that's a good example of you don't look at just the record of the trial. There was no error in the Pate case, but yet it was unfair to let that conviction stand.
Ms. Moeller, I know your red light is on, but I believe this is a question that you'd probably be able to answer fairly economically. And that is, what level of deference, if any, and I apologize if you've covered it, but I have not heard the answer. What level of deference, if any, do we owe to the Court of Appeals determination here? And if we do owe deference, why are we not in at least as good a position as the Court of Appeals to review the trial court's determination?
I think the standard, as we talked about, is erroneous exercise of discretion. And I realize it's a very close question, but I think the error comes in not identifying why the case is exceptional and basically saying that Judge D'Amato's judgment was wrong, even though she explained why she could not find 51% by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Kucharski did not prevail on either prong. I think Justice Prosser, did you?
752.35 and 751.06, they apply to civil cases as well?
Correct.
And do they apply in criminal cases to collateral attack?
Well, that's an open question, I believe, on whether you can argue for a new trial in the interest of justice when you've got like a 974.06 motion. I think my recollection is that this court has granted new trials in the interest of justice where it's a collateral action.
And that hasn't happened over the last 100 years.
I'm trying to remember whether the Armstrong case wasn't one where there was a new trial in the interest of justice, or Hicks. I'm not sure which case.
Both
I'm thinking.
Of them were. Armstrong was, and okay. I think Hicks was too. I think Armstrong relied on Hicks.
And Armstrong was not a direct appeal. That was a collateral action.
Right.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just briefly. In an NGI, there are two phases. Guilt is the first phase of the trial, and that has to be reached by a unanimous jury if tried to a jury or, you know, if
correct.
The court takes a plea. The second phase does not require unanimity, however, right?
5-6.
So what, if any, impact should the fact that you don't need unanimity in the second phase of a trial have on the requirement that you have to show a substantial probability of a different result?
A good question, and it's one that I had not considered, because here, of course, we didn't have a jury trial. But
I mean, in and of itself, you don't need this evidence to be beyond a reasonable. I mean, you don't need the same standard. You don't need the same agreement. It seems like it should almost be even higher in the second phase of an NGI. I don't mean to just throw something out to you. This just came to me. Otherwise, I would have asked defense counsel the same thing.
But it's a good point, because you still have to convince 10 people. And presumably after what happened here, let's say this went back for a retrial, maybe the defense attorneys wouldn't be so quick to want to have a trial to just one person.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Moeller.
On behalf of the court, thank both counsel here for their excellent briefs and their excellent oral argument. Once again, where the court is asked to determine whether the Court of Appeals properly exercised its powers under 752.35. That ends our hearing on 2013-AP-557-CR, State versus Kucharski. The court will take a few moments of recess while these students leave and a new group of students come into the court. We are...